Bear with me, I am almost ready to go. All right, so everybody hear me all right? Okay, so as Mitzi mentioned, my name is Dr. Anderson. I am an upper cervical specialist, which means that the neck is really my forte. This is where I did most of my postgraduate studies. So after the 8 years of school, I did an additional 3 years on top of that so that I can be a specialist within the neck. And then after that, I did an additional year of studying to be certified with auto accidents. Unfortunately, auto accidents happen on a very, very regular basis here in southern Utah. Anybody have an idea of the average number of crashes that happen every single day here in southern Utah? Five? 15? 50 a day? No. Unfortunately, we're not that bad. We have between 8 and 10 a day. So if you look at the numbers, most car accidents have two vehicles, and most vehicles have two drivers, right? You have the driver of the one, the driver of the other. So that means that if you go on those numbers, that means we have between 480 and 600 crash victims every single day or every single month, and that's an unreal amount. And you would think that in a small community like southern Utah, that's not really small anymore, that it would actually be much less than that, but unfortunately it is much higher. So I saw the need. I saw, in essence, the writing on the wall that this was an area that, with an upper cervical, there was the need for auto accidents as well. So that's where the marriage began. So what we're going to do today is we're going to kind of go over these general topics. Some of them are a little bit unrelated. Some of them are very related. So as we go through this, if you have any questions, by all means, interrupt me, ask away. I don't like being like the center of attention as much as I like to be the one who likes to communicate. So if you have a question, please interrupt me, okay? Deal?
Okay, I have a question.
Yeah, sure.
I was just wondering, is it mostly college students that are in these accidents, or us older people?
You know what? It's across the board.
It really
is across the board. The average age of my patient is not really that average. It's kind of across the board. We have those that are older. We have those that are in college. We have those that are in high school. We have the children of the people that are middle-aged that are employees of the world. It really doesn't matter. It's across the board. And so what we'll see is influxes. Yes. The older that you get, your eyesight isn't there, your reaction time isn't there. These are realities. These are things that we have to deal with. But on the same token, you go down to the college age where you do have those reflexes and you do have the eyesight, but you're distracted. So equally, they're kind of across the board. So great question, though. All right, so the first thing we're going to talk about, just some basic statistics. Did you know that every year, 42,000 people are killed in a motor vehicle collision or a motor vehicle crash in the United States? And this number has been pretty stable since 1921. Now, why is that? Why is it that it's been pretty stagnant? 42,000 people killed every single year since 1921. Okay, vehicles are safer, but we have more people. Seatbelts definitely are saving lives, for sure.
Airbags.
We're going to talk about all of those things. But interestingly enough, it's been pretty stagnant. And it means that there's an average of one death every 13 minutes. So, which is crazy. Now, let's talk about the next one. We all know the number of people that were killed in the 9/11 terrorist attacks, correct? Okay? There are more people killed every single month than were lost in a 9/11 terrorism attack from car crashes. So this is a big issue. Motor vehicle collisions are the leading cause of preventable death in children. That's sad, but that's a reality. These are just basic statistics. Seatbelts reduce the risk of injury and serious injury or death by 42%. Why not 100%? Okay? Correct. So here's the interesting thing. What does the seatbelt do? It keeps you in the car, yes. It keeps you sliding down onto the underdash. Keeps your head from going through the windshield. In essence, it's the same answer. It restrains you. It keeps you, the body, from moving forward. But if you had the seatbelts going, if you had the seatbelts going across your chest and across your lap, you are contained. But what is your head doing? Yeah, that's exactly it. So, who in here likes NASCAR? One person. Okay. So you have all heard of Dale Earnhardt, correct? And you know what happened with Dale Earnhardt? He died. He ran into the wall at about 200-plus miles an hour. And when you look at the footage, it doesn't look like he really hit that hard. But it killed him. And since then, they have developed the thing called the Hans device. And the Hans device is basically this thing that goes up above your head, wraps around your body, and then your helmet clips into this Hans device. So that way, if you are involved in any type of a head-on collision, it's like a seatbelt for your head. It allows turn. Yes?
The brain is still wobbling inside.
Yes, it is. The brain is still wobbling. But the difference is, the reason why Dale Earnhardt died is he was neurologically decapitated. As the head goes this direction, the amount of velocity and force detached that spinal cord from the brain. The brain itself, or the body, the head and the body were still attached, but everything on the internal workings is not, which leads to a great question. If you're involved in a crash, what happens to the brain? More importantly, what happens to the spinal cord? Yes, it bobbles around. The spinal cord is not designed to stretch. It just isn't. It is a very static device. Electrical impulses are sending through the brain to the body, but it's not designed to do this. And this is how he was neurologically decapitated. So if you have this impact where your head goes forward, your spinal cord stretches, your brain wobbles, and another problem is that the brain is very soft. Everybody thinks that the brain is this kind of pliable, jello, mold, but it's actually much goopier than that. And any type of impact, yes, it's going to go forward, it's going to go back, but as your head goes all the way forward and it goes like this, then you have this thing called the cerebellar tonsils that can get pulled down through the opening that your spinal cord goes through, called the foramen magnum. And there's a condition called Arnold Chiari syndrome. Some of you may have heard of Arnold Chiari syndrome, but basically it creates a lot of neurological issues. And it can happen due to a traumatic event like a car accident. Anyway, we're derailing there for a little bit. Even though the seatbelt will decrease your chance of serious injury or death by 42%, 30% of the population doesn't wear them, which I think is very disturbing. One of the things that I do on the side, I'm also a firefighter. And for a while, I was an EMT. And we would go on calls, car accidents, all the time. When I used to run with Dixie Ambulance for a little while, and one of the most adrenaline pumping things for me was a car accident, just because of the trauma that can go. And that was one of the things that we always dealt with, was people that would not wear a seatbelt or wear it improperly. So we're going to talk about how to properly wear them. Child restraining systems. They have many names, but one of the most identifiable names that's out there is basically it's an orphan creator. Because typically, a child that has the five-point harness and is within that high back or the car seat typically is going to fare very well. Yes, but let's talk about that. If they are faced backwards and you're in a rear-ending crash, which direction do they go? They go this direction. So for them, a rear-ending crash is a front impact. Frontal impact. Okay, so it's a catch-22. If you get rear-ended, your infant that's in the back or your grandchild that's in the back can have, in essence, the same thing as a front-on impact for those that are sitting forward-facing. So it's that catch-22. What do you do? Well, what you do is you do what you need to do. You put the kid in the car seat the correct facing way, properly restrained, and you hope for the best. So, here's the sad part. 40% of all children that are killed in a motor vehicle collision are not properly restrained, which then brings us to this next part. How do you properly restrain your child? Duct tape doesn't count. Okay? So here's an interesting story. My sister-in-law, when she had her first child, you've got the buckle that comes between the legs, and you have the straps that go over the shoulders, and then it comes across the lap and clips in. She put her son's legs through that strap, so the legs were up like this with the strap. Now, she didn't keep them like that, but that was what she did at the very first. She's like, that doesn't look right. So you need to learn how to properly restrain your child.
But it's not just the harness and stuff. You have to, don't you actually seatbelt in the child's car seat?
Oh, absolutely. They have the anchor devices where you can clip those things into the anchor of the car, and those things are bolted into the frame of the car. So in essence, that seat is an extension of the seat itself, the car seat. So everything within that car seat has everything to do with that strap. It will keep them there. It will not become a projectile.
Okay, well, I think that's part of the problem, too. I tried to put in a grandkid's car seat. Nah, I think I had to call the dad. I couldn't figure it out.
Yeah.
Those things, some of them are not easy.
They're not. They're not. So, well, my sister-in-law is much younger than I am, so it's not just old people. All right, so we have between 7 and 8 million crashes on the highway in the U.S. every single year. 3 million of them have whiplash. That's a pretty big number. And this has been the case for a very, very long time, since 1921. We have... I'm sorry? Okay, let's talk about it. Well, I could talk about the headrest. We're going to talk about it. How about we talk about it now and we just jump over it then? Let's do that. Okay, head restraints. Everybody calls them a headrest. It's not a headrest. That's not what it's for. It's a head restraint. What is the head restraint supposed to do? Restrain the head. It's not a place to take a nap, especially while you're driving. It is a head restraint. It is to prevent your head from being whipped backwards. So let's talk about how this all happens. Your car is hit, and when your car is rear-ended, what happens is it compresses down on the springs of the car. You're not a part of the vehicle, so therefore you don't compress down. You ramp up, and as you ramp up, if you have that head restraint too low, then it becomes very low. And because it's that impact of your body being thrown backwards, and we've got some video we'll show about this, the head whips over the top of that head restraint, which is why it needs to be up high. So in your cars, let's think of your cars right now. Where is that head restraint?
Right up here.
Way up high. If the top of the head restraint is below the middle of your head, it's too low and you're at risk. You need to get that thing up as high as you can get it. But the biggest complaint that I hear, unfortunately, don't throw anything at me, comes from women. We don't want to mess up my hair. I got a ponytail. Right. So it's uncomfortable. And then you're at risk. And I apologize for that, but I don't, because you should know better now. You've been taught. Yeah. A wheelchair is much more uncomfortable. There are some cars... Hondas are notorious for this. They prop that thing so far forward that it's uncomfortable. And it's a hard back on the other side, so you can't turn it around because that's not enjoyable. And so people, I have a patient right now that actually took hers out. And she was rear-ended at 60 miles an hour. And there's a lot of damage that came from that one. So even though it's uncomfortable, which is worse? A little bit of uncomfortable... change your seat position, or chronic potential lifetime pain and problems. So just think through that one. All right, so let's talk about seatbelts. Seatbelts, the myths. I only need them when I'm on the highway, right? Okay, obviously, as you can see, wrong. That's not the case. Most crashes happen at 40 miles an hour and below. Here's a little factoid. Here's a question for you. what is that delineating speed that determines between a high-speed crash and a low-speed crash? 25? 20? 10 to 15? Okay. 5 miles an hour? Yeah. There is 10 miles an hour. Anything over 10 miles an hour is considered a high-speed crash. So if you have a crash that speeds under 40 miles an hour, you are just involved in a high-speed crash if it at least is over 10 miles an hour. But here's a little interesting thing. You can also get whiplash or serious injury 5 miles an hour. And that comes to risk factors, and we'll talk about risk factors in a little bit. So here is another question. I can just brace if I'm in a crash if it's under 25 miles an hour. So the equivalent, as you can see down here in this lower right side, it says 25 mile an hour is your speed after falling from a three-story building. So who can jump off of a building, a three-story building, and then brace yourself right before you end and be okay? You can't do it. I have another patient. She was sitting in the middle seat between the front seats, the driver and the passenger up front, not wearing her seatbelt. She's in the middle. Not in the front two seats, but the middle row. So it was a back row, the middle row, and then the two front seats. So she's sitting in the middle. She's got a sibling here and a sibling there, and that car rear-ends somebody, and she's not wearing her seatbelt. So in the process of the brakes being slammed, she goes forward, grabs hold of the seats in front of her. The impact happens, and everything just goes like this, like that. Okay, lots of problems that can come from that. You cannot brace from a three-story fall. You just can't. So that's a myth. All right, so I want you to watch this video, and I want you to try to guess the speeds of these two cars. And it'll just keep playing. It'll loop. So let's talk about this. What are the speeds? Let's look at the damage. Okay, the front ends of the tan car on the right, quite buckled. And the hood on the other car, propped up, but the whole bumper front end is all kind of mangled. The car on the right, 17 miles an hour. Car on the left, 26 miles an hour. And you have that much damage. It does not take a lot. So here's another myth. If I have an airbag, I don't need a seatbelt. Okay, that's absolute false. An airbag only increases your decrease, if that makes any sense. It increases your decreased risk by only 12%.
So, and if you go forward and then the airbag deploys, it's going to throw you back.
Correct. So wearing your seatbelt is primary. An airbag only dampens that impact. And of course, you can go underneath the front dash. You can go over the top of it. What is the decrease potential? Well, it's 43 plus 12.
Okay, so over 50%.
It's over 50%. So basically it's saying you're not impervious to getting injured. It can happen. You have a 45% chance that you will get injured. So you basically absolutely must wear your seatbelt. Now, the next myth, women who are pregnant shouldn't wear their seatbelt because it'll damage their fetus. Okay, and that's also false. Put the belt below the belly. Correct. Your fetus will be absolutely fine. So if they try to use that excuse, it's no. Don't buy it. Don't put it underneath your arm. It goes across the shoulder. If you go underneath your arm, you run the risk of fracturing ribs. So don't do that. All right, so there's three types of child restraining systems. You have a rear-facing. We talked about that one. We have a forward facing. This is from 20 pounds to 40 pounds. And then you have the booster seat. Let's talk about booster seats. There are two different types. The different types are the high back and the no back. And the no back is cheap. We got one for my parents to drive my son around, and it cost us $13. We have one for our vehicle for when he's going to be traveling the most, and it cost us $130.
The high back.
The high back. Okay, but the risk of injury is substantially higher with a no back booster than it is a high back. Substantial. So here's just some examples of placement, and we can talk about that, but we're going to run out of time if we're not careful. So these are just some videos on how to actually properly put it. So let's look at this one. 70% difference. You have a 70% reduced risk with a high back booster. 70%. Okay, that's the one that has the big cradle around the head, so side impact, which is one of the biggest killers for infants and children for a T-bone crash. Obviously, it's high enough, so you're not going to get that whiplash appeal. You got the restraint that's going across them. They're a much better deal. For children, traumatic brain injuries are the biggest insult, the biggest injury. And so when you look at what type of injuries a child can have, and they can have all of them, but how do you know? We have a number of patients that are younger, age 3 to 6, and they have absolutely no idea how to express that they are hurt. So how do they tell you? You look at the child. You look at their emotions. Are they a different child than what they were before the crash? And if they are, then there's a very strong chance that they're dealing with something like a traumatic brain injury or a mild traumatic brain injury, depending on the severity of it. So that has a lot to do on the parents or the grandparents' responsibility to observe their child or grandchild to see what has happened. Are they more emotional? Are they all of a sudden abusive? Are they hitting? Are they throwing things? Are they having a real tough time sleeping? Are they not eating? These are big indicators that something is going on for that child. So if you've noticed something, if you have a grandchild, if you've noticed something about them that is different, and they've been in a crash, very likely they're dealing with some type of either a traumatic or a mild traumatic brain injury. And that needs to be addressed, or it will cause a lot of problems down the road. All right, so we talked about airbags. Okay, how do they work? Everybody thinks that there's a sensor in the bumper. I guess I can't lump everybody. Not everybody thinks that. Many people think that there is a sensor inside that bumper. And if you hit something, that little sensor is going to trigger and it's in it. It's actually something that's underneath the driver's seat. That's where that device is. And so that change of velocity, that change of momentum will trigger the release of that. And so it sends that signal. It'll detonate that little tablet. We'll throw the air into the airbag, pop the steering wheel or anywhere else on the car, and then you have that nice soft brick that you land on, because it's not soft. It's not a pillow. It's nice and firm, but it's a whole lot better than a steering wheel or a windshield or concrete. So that in itself has its own risk. Years ago, they had a super, I guess you could call it like a hot load within the detonation, and it would produce a velocity. I think it was between 160 and 210 miles an hour. That's something coming at you at 200 miles an hour. I don't think that's going to feel good. So they have new smart airbags that can gauge the weights and sensitivity within that seat so that it dampens that load so not everything projects out. But it's pretty big. So here we go. This right here is a 36-mile-an-hour crash head-on. And they're testing the airbags of it. They have a live, we'll call them a dummy, riding in the vehicle to demonstrate the deployment of an airbag. So that was kind of slow. Now you're going to have the slow speed impact, and you will see the airbags detonate. And there it is. He compresses in. and it's all good. But that was 36.9 miles an hour, and there's what is known as a 17.1 delta V, change of velocity. Okay? So that meant that his head went from 0 to 17.1 just like that, which put 10.3 Gs on his head. That's enough to cause somebody to black out. This is at 36 miles an hour, 37 miles an hour. That's not very fast, really. And it's enough that could cause somebody to black out. So airbags are very vital, but also understand that they have their limitations as well. Okay, we already talked about that. All right, placement. Who in here is vertically challenged? That's a nice way of asking who in here is short. Okay. The closer that you are to the steering wheel, can you see the predicament here? The closer that you are, the more that thing's going to come right into you. You need to be at least 10 inches away, steering wheel to chest. Otherwise, it's going to be right there, and it can cause broken bones. When I was working for Dixie Ambulance, there was a few crashes where they would have a broken nose, broken jaw bones. Their face would be black and blue almost immediately just because of that quick impact right into the face. So try to be cognitive of that. They have adjustable steering, steering wheel, yes, but also adjustable pedals. You can move your pedals much closer to keep that steering wheel further apart from you. It's better to be far away than right on top of it. But those that are vertically challenged, we'll just have to work with that one, Ralph. Okay. What's that? Okay. So who's seen people driving down the road with their legs propped up on the dash, relaxing? Okay, who has done that? Hopefully not the teenage girls, yes. I've seen that. Even out the window, yes. These are things that can cause broken bones, serious problems, serious pain. Don't put your legs up onto the dash. That's just a public safety announcement. All right, we already talked about head restraints, but let's touch a little bit. They were designed for aircraft, for fighter jets. They were designed to really take on the load so that those quick maneuvers, your head's not going to whip out, and then you're going to end up with whiplash and die. So they designed them, and then starting in 2008, they started having these new head restraint requirements, and it's just been getting better and better. There are a couple of companies, Saab and Volvo, they have designed their own special seats that are designed to take away that risk. But, obviously, it's a risk. It still will be there. But at least they're making some headway with it. They're actually pretty good. Anyone in here drive a Saab or a Volvo? Okay. We talked about that one. All right, so placement. We've already talked about the height. Let's talk about another thing. So known as the back set. So the top set is from shoulder to head. Where does that head restraint rest? But now the back set is how far back do you go? In this example, we have the top one is ideal. You want it to be about 2 to 3 inches away from the back of your head, though. So we already know how high it's supposed to be, but how far back? So who in here likes to ride with your seat reclined? Everybody wants it propped up, straight up and down? Good. I don't have to teach you guys anything new on that one. So that's the top set, is how high it is. And the back set is right there. So the bottom one is a bad setup. The top one is a good setup. About 2 to 3 inches back from head restraint to the back of your head. Now, I have my seat propped up, and I actually drive with my head on the head restraint because I don't want any risk. I don't want any type of chance of movement. My head is in contact with the head restraint 95% of the time because I never know.
So you're saying you can have less than 2 to 3 inches?
I'm sorry? Oh, absolutely. You can have it zero. As long as your head is on top of it, that's good. Right. We don't want more than three. So we kind of missed this one. So this video right here will show the difference between what a good head restraint and a bad head restraint placement. The video on the left is bad You see how his head got whipped over like this? And then the one on the right is good. I don't necessarily like the back set, how far her head is away from it. But once again, these are our human dummies. Okay? I didn't pay them. And by the way, they're volunteers. They did it for the sake of the excitement. I guess. I don't know. I can't think of anybody else or any other reason why they would do that. The one on the left, much higher risk for whiplash. And by the way, that guy did get injured. The girl on the right did not. Okay. Here's the biggest question that I hear. What do you do if you know that you're about to get hit? Rear-ended. What do you do?
Cover your eyes with your hands.
Scream. Cover your eyes, Sherry, so you don't, if you don't see them, they don't see you, and they'll just drive around you. You're invisible. What do you do? Without looking at the words, what do you do? Yeah. If you're at a stop, you mash that brake as hard as you can, both feet. Push that brake. Grip that steering wheel, but not with your thumbs. You open palm it. You push yourself back as hard as you can. You push your head into that head restraint as hard as you can. Why would we do that? Right. If you give your body any chance for that brain to jostle, then it is going to cause a lot of pain, some problems. So if you're curious about where you can learn more, there's the IIHS, the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. They've done a lot of studies. You can find a tremendous amount of information on there. The other place you can go is the Spine Research Institute of San Diego, which is where I got certified for the auto accidents. There's a tremendous amount of research that goes into this. Okay, so here's another example of head restraint movements. Sorry, the picture is so small, but the difference between the head restraints and the placements. If you notice, the top one is very rigid, whereas the bottom one really bent and flexed over. So let's do it again. So notice how he ramped up on the seat, the lower one, okay? And then the head comes back and just folds, whereas the top one, it really restrained it. So the quality of head restraint is pretty significant. And this came from the Insurance Institute. Okay, so I know that many of you have driven vehicles before they had anti-lock brakes, right? Probably all of you. I did. What does an anti-lock brake do? It keeps it from locking, right? Just the name tells you everything that it needs to be. Why is it supposed to not lock? So you can steer. And one of the biggest problems, and this is something that I think everybody in this room needs to know because you have all driven vehicles without anti-lock brakes. You remember the days where you feather the brake so that it didn't lock up on you? Don't do that. Mash that foot as hard as you can on that brake. You feel that brake pulsate. That's a good thing. You want it to do that. Don't take your foot off of it. Don't go back to the old days where you feather it. Just mash it and hold it because you can steer.
And don't stop pushing when it starts to vibrate because you still may have more brake power.
Right, that's what I'm saying. Once that thing starts to vibrate, don't take your foot off. Keep pushing harder and harder and harder. Yeah. And my little rule of thumb, if you know that you're about to get hit and you brace yourself and you close your eyes and you scream, right, don't look into the rearview mirror until either you get honked at or somebody knocks on your window. Because things slow down. What you think should have happened hasn't happened yet. And a lot of times they'll do this, and then they'll look up, and that's when it hits you. So, just...
Yeah, I've had an accident, and things went into slow motion.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything slows down. When you are about to have some type of an event like that, everybody says, my life flashed before my eyes. And for some of us, it wasn't that exciting. But it happens so fast that everything slows down. And so your ability to gauge time goes out the window. So keep your foot on the brake. Brace yourself. And if you get honked at, then you can start moving forward. Then you can look, but not until then, okay?
And the noise that anti-lock brakes make when you slam along and hold it, you think your car is ruined,
but don't be afraid of it.
Yeah, as long as you know that.
But you know that.
I do now.
You do now. So now you've been taught. There's a saying that Confucius said, to know and to not do is to not yet know. But you know, so now go do. Okay? All right. We've already talked about those. Stability control used to be kind of a high-end vehicle thing. It's kind of become mainstream now. Vehicles these days have this stability control. It tells you where to put the power. It doesn't tell you. It just does it automatically. You put on the brake and you're turning, it'll put the amount of brake to the appropriate thing so you don't lose control and spin. It allows you, as you're steering, to put the power in the right spot. My goodness, they even have vehicles that will do it all for you now. You can just drive like this. Those are expensive, but it's coming. What's that?
So you get the truck.
Right. So stability control is kind of a thing that's mainstream now. It's getting there. Here's another question. How do you choose a safe car? What is a safe car?
A big car.
Big car, right? Okay. Have you ever heard of the lug nut rule? Once heard of the lug nut rule. What is the lug nut rule?
More lug nuts, safer
car. Yeah. He who has the most lug nuts wins. All right. So if you're driving a big Ford truck, the F-350, and you've got your 8-bolt pattern, and you go up against a little Suzuki Swift with a 4-bolt pattern, who's going to win?
The truck
will. Okay? Every time. However, what happens when it comes down to stability on tight corners? Who's going to win? The little car, because you have a higher center of gravity. So just because you have a bigger vehicle doesn't mean that you had the safer vehicle.
Have more maneuverability.
Right. So it comes down to the appropriate car for the appropriate job. And, just because it's expensive doesn't mean it's the best car.
So a sedan would do better on maneuverability than
an SUV. Absolutely. Absolutely. However, the sedan will lose any time it goes up against an SUV. Yeah?
Well, I always figured that Volkswagen Beetle was smaller and harder to hit.
Yeah, they're quick. They're kind of like cats. No, the thing with the smaller the vehicle, yes, you have greater stability within tight cornering. They are faster. They're more agile. But on the same token, if they are involved in some type of a collision, they're not going to fare if you're up against a larger vehicle. That's just how it is. The lug nut rule is a rule. It's law. So you can't break that law. Correct. It's designed to handle impact. If you were to take a vehicle made from Korea, and I can talk about the Hyundai or the Kia, doesn't matter. If you look at those cars and you compare those cars to a car that's made in Japan, what's the difference? They're both foreign, but one is definitely a lighter weight vehicle. And you typically will find that with the Korean cars. The Japanese cars are a more solid vehicle. You can tell the difference just by the way it feels when you drive. If you've ever driven both of them side by side, the Korean vehicles just feel like tin cans. So how do you choose a vehicle? You can go to, yes?
Does the owner's manual tell you how many lug nuts you have?
I would think just looking at your car would probably be the easiest. Go look at your wheel.
Oh,
it's the thing that holds your tire. Those are lug nuts.
Oh.
Yeah. It's probably faster just to go like this.
Oh.
Then to flip to a page. All right. So SUVs, their biggest thing is rollover. They're higher. They tip over. T-bone crashes with an SUV has a higher mortality rate than, yeah, it's true, than trucks. The reason behind that is because they're taller and they have a shorter wheelbase, typically. In regards to collisions, not necessarily. All-wheel drive does better in inclement weather, but in terms of collision protection, not necessarily. It really comes down to the vehicle itself. You can go to the IIHS, and you can also go to the NHTS websites, and they have different ratings. They will tell you, this car fared better than this car, or this car has a 5-star rating for this and a 3-star rating for that, and you can go through and you can look at them. Oddly enough, Mercedes is not that good of a car when it comes to collision. It comes down to the design, the build. So take that into account. All right, let's jump to the questions. We've already kind of touched on all those things. Does anybody have any questions that we haven't talked about? Yes?
Hand placement on the steering
wheel. I'm sorry, say again?
Where do you put your hands on the steering wheel?
Oh, great question.
Yeah, that's
okay, everybody wants, yeah, the 10 and 2 is what we were taught when I was a kid, and that's changed. It's now 4 and 6. Why would that be?
Airbags.
Right? Your hands up here, airbags go off. Could fracture your forearm. Have your hands down here, and it's a much easier load. You could also dislocate your shoulders from the airbags coming this direction. So, great question. Hands down here.
Automobile age. Age of a car.
Right?
The newer cars are safer than the one 10 years ago?
Sure. But why? It's because of the technology that's put into the vehicle. It isn't necessarily, there is something to do with the actual quality of the metal. And so here's another question. If you were to take like a 56 Bel Air, no, better yet, let's go same to same. Let's go with a 60 Impala with a 95 Impala. Okay, you have the classic boat. The steel structure, the tank, the indestructible machine, and you put it up against a vehicle that is designed with crumple zones, who is going to fare better? The one with the crumple zones. In fact, there is a video, if you guys want to look on YouTube, there's a video, it's a 56 Impala, or Bel Air against a something Impala. It's like a 96 or 98, maybe it's a 2000. But they do this head-on collision, and they have cameras inside both vehicles. And it is absolutely amazing on the destruction of the 56 Bel Air.
And the old ones used to have steel dashes and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, no padding or anything.
Or seatbelts, for that matter.
Yeah. So you were lucky if you went through the windshield instead of hitting that hump of steel.
You prayed for an ejection. Yeah. It's true. So the age of the vehicle does have something to do with it, but, you know, within a range. It's because of technology. So the classic cars, they're not so classic anymore in my eyes. Yeah, sure.
This table doesn't know what crumple zone.
Okay, so a bottle. Okay, and anybody have an empty bottle? So when the car hits, it's designed to crumple. Okay, it's designed to have little zones on the vehicle to compress in to dampen that impact. It also has where the engine is supposed to break from the motor mounts and come down so that you don't go into the motor or the motor doesn't come into you.
What's the steering wheel collapse?
The steering wheel collapses. There's just so much safety technology that's gone into vehicles now that it's crazy to think the difference between the years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no padding. There's no niceties. You have the three spokes with the center spear.
Yeah, spear.
Yeah, rough.
What do you think of self-driving cars?
What do I think of them? Mm-hmm. I want one. I really do. I love driving short distances. I hate driving long distances. I get bored. And so I would much rather have a vehicle that's going to do all that for me. And it will drive me to wherever I want to go. And as soon as I get into town and traffic, then I can take over. But on the freeway, having something, I could take a nap. How great would that be? Yeah. Cross stitch. Yes, in the back. That you're on fire? Yeah. So the smell comes from the detonation of the little tablet. So that is correct. The smoke that's blowing through the air is not smoke. That's talcum powder. And they put that on there so that the airbag comes out. Otherwise, based upon the heat, things could bind. You could have a total rupture within that bag, and then it's non-functional. So when you think that your car is on fire, because it smells, you see a smoke. You smell because it's like gunpowder, but you see talcum powder. So, yes?
I thought you'd speak more about defensive driving or things that we as drivers can do.
I was just about to get to that. Okay, so defensive driving, what does that mean? A strong offense is a strong defense, is that right? What is defensive driving? How do you drive defensively? Yes, anticipation is the biggest thing. Yeah.
You let the obsessive drivers have their way. You're polite.
Okay. Space. Space is a big thing. But here's another thing. This is another way to be defensive, and this seems a little bit contradictory. One of the things that I've seen is when people are in a new area and they're lost, they just stop. Or have you seen that before? I've never seen that one. Okay. They are you guilty? You backed up on an exit ramp? Oh, wow.
Yeah, but you see, defensive driving says expect the stupidest thing to happen and be prepared for it.
But how do you know what the stupidest thing is?
Are you
put him behind the wheel? Okay, one of the things that I've done is I actually look into their rear-view mirror. I look into their rear-view mirror because I can see what they're doing as I'm driving. And I keep probably 3 car lengths difference between me and the vehicle in front of me. But I look in their rear-view mirror or their side-view mirrors, and I can see what they're doing. I can see if they're looking down or they're looking over here. You watch their speed. Is it erratic? Are they slowing down? Are they speeding up? Are they kind of drifting? Yeah. You can't blame the cell phones completely. I've seen people read books while they're driving. Now that's talent. Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah. Yep. Do you know what that's called? Where they put makeup while they're driving? Anyone know what this is called?
Farting.
I've never heard that before. It's farting. Where did they come up with that name? That is a fun one. Okay. So defensive driving really comes just to observation, awareness, paying attention to the surroundings, watching what traffic is doing, knowing your surroundings, and keeping space and distance.
I always watch people behind me.
That too. But the problem with watching people behind you is that you're not watching the people in front of you.
You know they're back there.
Yeah.
I'm aware.
Right. But the other part, and this is one thing I didn't talk about, and we have 5 minutes, right? Okay. Or-ish. Okay. So risk factors. What are risk factors? I touched on the fact that you can get injured at 5 miles an hour, but it requires certain risk factors. And a risk factor has everything to do with you, the individual, the occupant. So let's talk about some of them. One of the biggest things that can cause injury is head placement. So with you talking about seeing behind you, Okay? You're not doing this.
Yeah,
you're doing
I,
this.
I use the mirrors. I don't look
you right. use your mirrors, but you turn your head to look in the mirrors. You do a little bit. I understand that, but my point is that to look in your surroundings, which you should be doing, requires that you're turning your head.
Yeah.
And if you are in the back seat of a vehicle and you're trying to talk to the person in the front seat and you're leaning your head forward or your body forward, then all of a sudden you're at greater risk. What happens when you turn your head is that all the ligaments and tendons and everything within your spine and your neck all of a sudden become tight. And what happens if you take a rubber band and you stretch it to its capacity and then you stretch it a little bit further? It snaps. Imagine that your muscles are full of little micro rubber bands. And when you turn your head, you tense them all up. And any type of an impact right there is going to be that extra force.
That's why it's a problem with looking for the collision.
Yeah.
I think I may have looked at the center of the rear view.
Right. You're still trying to justify your actions. I get it.
I want to know who's behind me.
Understandable. I do too. And I look in my rearview mirror too. I just want everybody to know that looking in the mirror tenses up the muscle slightly. It puts you at a greater risk. It's a risk factor. Age. I'm sorry. Age is an increased risk factor.
Physical shape too.
Physical shape.
You work out or not.
Absolutely. Muscle tone. Yeah, he's Superman. No, nothing can hurt him. The other thing, I didn't make the rules here. Women are twice as likely to be injured than men for that reason. No, it's muscle tone.
They got neuro.
Right. Then we start talking about body mass or body, body mass. I won't say the index because we're not looking for weight. I'm talking about just people that are small frame like myself. I am at a much higher risk than somebody.
Long neck.
Well, yeah. Long. It's kind of skinny. Come on. So that's another thing. Have you had a previous injury to your neck? Do you have any type of degeneration within your spine? Did you get hit by a vehicle that's larger than your vehicle? You may be in, an 8-lug-nut truck, and you get hit by a semi. You're not going to survive very well. I mean, you'll survive probably, but maybe. So there are risk factors that will increase your risk of injury. So you have, take away your blind spots a little bit. Right.
And safe driving courses like AARP are the thing you should do.
Yeah, that's a great option. I strongly recommend
it.
It
lowers your insurance.
Yeah, it gives you 5% off.
5% off.
Yeah. No. Sure.
One of my biggest pet peeves is somebody who's following me very close.
Mm-hmm.
And they're right on my butt. And so my natural reaction is step on the brake.
Yes, the brake check.
But that's probably not the best thing to do, is it?
No, you should not.
What should you do if somebody's really ticking you off?
Annoy him.
Slow down.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to take the appropriate answer, is what she said, pull over, let them go by. I'm kind of an antagonist a little bit. So if the speed limit's 25, I usually do 5 over. And if somebody's right on my bumper, then I'll slow down to 20. I don't recommend going James Bond on them, like flipping the switch and dumping all the oil all over the road. I don't recommend that.
Well, but one of the easiest things, there's a tendency, particularly for heavy traffic, if somebody's pushing you from behind, you close up on
Correct.
Extra.
Yes.
So you don't have to do anything quickly.
The double impact is quite damaging.
He doesn't have the time, the following distance, to react to you doing something quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So everything you do is going to be slow, you know, slow down, slow.
Which is the reason why I keep my head on the head restraint. Because if I have to stop, I know I'm getting hit. And I'm going to do everything I can to prevent injury.
You know, that doesn't always work, though. When my kids were young, and I just had two or three or four of them at the time, I was no seatbelts, because you didn't have seatbelts. And I had this car. It was a big car, but it had the steering ring, you know, that you just push the silly...
The ring, yeah.
Yeah. So I was going down a one-lane road with this furniture truck in front of me, and traffic was coming on this road. I couldn't pull out behind the furniture truck. He was a delivery truck. And he started slowing down. And there were cars behind me, so I was getting really close to him, okay? And I couldn't pull out because I couldn't see. I didn't want to be head on. Next thing I knew, the truck started backing up. I guess he had gone by the road he was looking for. He didn't see me behind him. The first thing I did was yell at my boys to jump over the seat, because they were in the front seat.
Right.
Jump over, get in the back seat. And I pushed on that steering, that horn thingy, broke it, just totally broke it. And this truck continued to back up. His back tires were up off the ground, and the back of his truck was like 2 inches from my windshield.
Wow.
Scared me half to death. Talk about slow motion.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and then the thing is, he had another person in the truck, and I guess when they back up, their passenger, it's company policy that they're supposed to get out to make sure that.
Right.
Well, they didn't.
But he didn't do it.
Yeah.
Right, because that's just too inconvenient.
But it was very scary.
Yeah.
No, I didn't sue him, but they did pay for the damage.
You had a question.
I was going to say that when you know that there's an accident going to happen, your whole body tenses up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that makes all those injuries even worse.
Not necessarily. See, there's a big myth about the drunk drivers are going to get injured less than the non-drunk drivers, and that's actually not true. They get injured more. But you only hear about the stories where they didn't get injured. And so that becomes mainstream. But actually, the more flaccid that you are, the greater your risk of injury, because things are moving a whole lot more. Bracing yourself, absolutely it is.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm glad you told me that was a myth.
It is. It's absolutely a myth.
I go online and look at different accidents, and there's one I saw with a BMW. Got in an accident, and it rolled on the side, and the person who was the passenger went out the moon room.
Yeah. Yeah, we responded on a vehicle crash about 3 years ago where he was leaving an intersection and a big truck, bigger than his truck, came and hit him, broadsided him, turned him on his side. Well, he didn't eject out, but he climbed out of his sunroof, and he doesn't remember any of it. It was pretty significant traumatic brain injury. Yeah, it's true. So one of the things that I've done is I have created what I call the crash packet. And the crash packet is basically a step-by-step guide for you, the driver, or the occupant, if there is ever a crash. Because a lot of times your ability to think through the step-by-step goes out the window. And what I've created is something that is designed to basically hold your hand through the process. So I brought them for you. What I recommend is stick your insurance information into one side of it. Keep it in your glove box, because if it's not in your glove box, you can't. It doesn't do you any good. So Rachel has them over at the desk, and so please take as many as you need. I have many of them. I'm trying to get them into every glove box of St. George and Southern Utah. So thank you for letting me come. This has been fun.